are there any questions about yesterday's talk? Yes, please. Aha, we had a scalar field, C, which will had this Z2 symmetry. There's only one way for a scalar field in two dimensions to have such a Z2 symmetry, and that it is if it is compact and compact with a particular radius. Now, there is an analogy here, and I stress it's only an analogy with Wolschmidt conformal field theory at the self-dual radius. It's only where T-duality enters, and then there is an enhanced SU2 cross SU2. I really have to stress it's only an analogy because here, this symmetry is a symmetry in space-time, not a symmetry on the Wolschmidt. So whenever you see a two-dimensional field theory which has that particular radius, and it doesn't matter whether it appears in condensed matter physics or on the Wolschmidt in string theory, or in this particular case in space-time, we always have an SU2 cross SU2 symmetry. Any other questions? Yes. Well, S-duality imposes some of that. It shows that the coefficient at T should be the inverse of the coefficient. The function of T should be such that F of T is 1 over F of minus T. That's what it tells you. This is a Z2 thing. There are more detailed considerations, which I did not explain here, which determine the whole functional form. The precise functional form is not that important for us, as long as it goes to infinity or to zero when T goes to infinity or plus infinity or minus infinity. That's all that then. In the weak coupling region, it's clearly 1. So it's 1 plus higher orders in T, and all we really need is that at the strong coupling end, so as T becomes large and positive or large and negative, it goes to infinity or zero. That's all we needed in the later discussion. But there are independent arguments for this functional form coming from many different considerations. It would take me too far afield to explain that. Yes. That's the simplest case. Well, there are even simpler theories with one-dimensional target space, but these are the simplest theories which have time. So these are simple examples, like why do people study the harmonic oscillator? Because it's very simple, and the question is how much physics can we extract from it? So we'll just, there aren't any other examples of string theories which can be analyzed at this level of detail, that these theories can be analyzed. And one can examine all sorts of phenomena that everybody discusses and write very concrete, explicit expressions for them and learn some lessons that can be used elsewhere. So that's the motivation. So today I'm going to take a totally different perspective on the subject and study the metrics model. Now, traditional presentations of the metrics model start from motivation, looking at the Feynman diagrams of the metrics model and so forth. I'm not going to do it here. In the spirit of duality of modern years, you just start a new story, the dual side, and then you check how it matches. I will later give a motivation for the metrics model from a more modern perspective, which was not available when it was first suggested. So for the moment, let's put the discussion of yesterday about the space-time description, let's put it on the back burner and take a fresh start and consider the metrics model. So the title is 1D. So the cast of characters, so we have time labeled by T, and phi of T is an n by n Hermitian matrix. And we are going to postulate that the model has UN gauge symmetry. What does it mean? It means that the theory is invariant and the phi of T goes to V dagger of T, phi of T V of t. So the UN gauge symmetry acts on phi by conjugation. So this is the way gauge symmetry always acts on matter field, but in this particular case, the matter field phi is in the adjoint. And now we want to write a Lagrangian for such gauge theories. So our Lagrangian is going to be trace. That will make sure it's gauge invariant. Will be a half, call all kinetic terms of a half, dt phi plus a commutator phi. Square minus u of phi, and this is in general some polynomial, which is a function of phi. So we all know that this Lagrangian is invariant provided that A transforms properly. So A of t, the gauge field, goes to v dagger dt v plus v dagger a v. So if we combine this action on the matter fields with this action on the gauge fields, the Lagrangian is invariant. And this term is invariant because we act on phi by conjugation, so it conjugates u, and the trace kills it. How do we deal with the gauge theory? Well, the first thing we want to do is fix a gauge. And there are two convenient gauges here. Gauge number one is A0. All A here is really A0 because we have only time. So we're going to pick a gauge, A equals 0. This is known as axial gauge. Axial gauge is nice because the measure is simple, everything is simple. The only thing we have to be careful about is that we have to remember to impose Gauss' law. Gauss' law is the equation of motion of the Lagrangian of A0 that we set to 0, or in other words, we set A to 0, we don't want to forget its equation of motion, so we impose it in by hand, and that's known as Gauss' law. So the variation of the Lagrangian, variation of the action with respect to A of t should be set to 0. And that is after we set A equals 0, the gauge condition. So it's minus dt phi, plus phi dt phi equals 0. If we set A to 0, the system is no longer invariant under SUN gauge or UN gauge transformation, but the UN gauge symmetry becomes a global symmetry. And this is the generator of the global symmetry. This is the charge of that global symmetry. And the statement of Gauss' law is the statement that we take this system, we set A to 0, we forget about it, we look at the, we solve the, diagonalize the Hamiltonian, we have a big set of states, space of states. There is a global symmetry UN, so the states are all in some representations of SUN. And Gauss' law tells us to forget all the states which are not invariant. Ignore all the states which are not gauge singlets. Keep only the singlets. So this is a first gauge choice, which is convenient. The second gauge choice, which is convenient, is to diagonalize so this is really what's known as axial gauge. And here we will diagonalize phi. This can be called by analogy to higher dimensions unitary gauge. So we diagonalize phi, and we say that phi of t at every time t is of the following form, lambda 1 of t, lambda 2 of t, up to lambda n of t. This doesn't fix the gauge symmetry completely. It leaves behind some remnant of the gauge symmetry, which acts by permutation of the lambdas. That's clearly remaining gauge symmetry. A still appears in the Lagrangian, but since there are no time derivatives and the Lagrangian is quadratic in A, we can integrate it out. And the remaining Lagrangian we have, call it effective Lagrangian, is sum over I, 1/2 lambda I square minus U of lambda I. So the different eigenvalues behave as independent degrees of freedom. They don't talk to one another. But life is not so simple. Here, where we're working classically, we should really be working quantum mechanically. And the quantum mechanical subtleties appear in a Hamiltonian formalism as ordering ambiguities. In other words, we might attempt it to write the Hamiltonian. So I'll put quotation marks around the equal sign as 1/2, maybe with a minus sign, d lambda I square plus u of lambda I. This is the correct answer classically, but it's the wrong answer quantum mechanically. In quantum mechanics, we have to be more careful about operator ordering, the proper measure of the functional integral, et cetera. And the answer, I'll just state the answer, rather than derive it and explain some consistency conditions. We had a measure of all phis, measuring the functional integral. We want to write it as measure on the group. All this is at any time t, times the product over I, d lambda I. This is what we still want to integrate over. But there could be a correction factor, a function of the lambda I's, some Jacobian. Let's see what it looks like. The Jacobian can be written as delta square of lambda, where delta of lambda is product over I bigger than j, lambda I minus lambda j. And the simplest way to understand that, well, one can actually derive it very explicitly by integrating A out carefully and putting Gauss for the gauge choice and so forth. But just intuitively, let's examine what happens to the gauge symmetry as the eigenvalues change. When two eigenvalues coincide, the remaining gauge symmetry is no longer just the SN, the permutation group of the different eigenvalues, but when two of them are equal, we have an enhanced SU2 gauge symmetry that rotates the two of them. But when we stripped off the factor of the measure with the volume of the gauge group here, we've already taken into account the volume of that SU2. To correct for that, the measure has to vanish at that point. And this factor guarantees that as any two lambdas are the same, the measure is zero. A nice analogy to keep in mind is the measure in polar coordinates. When we work in polar coordinates, we remove the angle phi, but the measure of integration is not dr, but it's rdr. And the extra r is very analogous to the zero. So the zero of the extra r in the measure of polar coordinates is analogous to the zero we get here when two eigenvalues coincide. When r equals zero, we have an enhanced symmetry under rotation. So when we strip off the factor of d phi in the measure, we have to correct by this extra factor of r. So this is a nice analogy to keep in mind. And the more detailed analysis shows that this factor is indeed there. So what are the consequences of this factor? It changes the kinetic term. The kinetic term is not minus 1/2 d lambda I square in the Hamiltonian, but as you always know, when there are measure factors, sum over I, when there are measure factors, the Laplacian is modified in a standard fashion. So we have minus 1/2 sum over I, 1 over delta square, d lambda I, delta square, d lambda I. That's standard form of the Laplacian when there is metric around, or when the measure is non-trivial. And I'll leave it as an exercise to you, for you to show that this is after some algebra. Now this can be written as minus a half, only one delta here, sum over I, d lambda I square, and one delta here. This factor of delta is known as the Vandermonde determinant, and it has all sorts of marvelous features that Mr. Vandermonde was the first to find. The next step is now easy. Recall if the naive Hamiltonian was this, and that looks like n independent variables. Here we see that the variables are not independent because of these correction factors of delta. However, we can now, in this form, we can easily remove delta. Let's substitute wave functions. Of the form, 1 over delta times some psi of lambda I. So these wave functions, psi of lambda I, see a Hamiltonian for this size, where this H is the naive Hamiltonian. So through a series of changes of variables, we managed to remove the measure factor. However, in the course of doing that, notice what happened. The original wave function was invariant under permutations of these lambdas. Why was it invariant? After we fixed this gauge choice, we still have remaining gauge symmetry of permutations of the lambdas, and the wave function has to be gauge invariant. So the original wave function was symmetric under the interchange of all these lambdas. These lambdas were bosons. Now we have stripped off a factor of delta, which is anti-symmetric under the interchange of two lambdas. Therefore, this wave function psi is anti-symmetric under the interchange of any lambdas. So we can think of psi as being a wave function of a many-body problem, but a many-body problem of fermions. So we have written the system in terms of free fermions. So psi of lambda I is a wave function of n independent fermions. Now, people use the term free fermions for many different things, and it's really important to distinguish between them. Meaning one, number one is what we see here. We have free fermions in the sense that one fermion does not interact with the other. The only interaction between them is due to Fermi statistics. The second meaning of free fermions is that we have free fermions which have a free wave equation. We don't have it here. These fermions are free in the sense that they do not interact with one another, but they are not free in the sense that they see an interesting Hamiltonian. Their Hamiltonian is not a free Hamiltonian. And this distinction will be very important to us soon. So what do we need to do now? We have some potential, U of lambda, and we have n fermions in that potential. So here is the potential U of, this is U of lambda, and it has wave functions. Some fermions are in this wave function. These energy levels, some are here. And we have some Fermi surface. So we fill all the levels up to some energy. And for the rest of the talk, I'll give two different presentations for finding these energy eigenfunctions. First will be semi-classical, which will give us some intuition to what's going on. And the other will be a more modern presentation, which will have some new insights about the physics. And the bottom line would be that if we feel, and this is, will not be a today's talk, maybe tomorrow, if we feel only one side of the potential, we feel only energy levels here, ignoring this, this will be the bosonic string. If we feel the two sides of the potential in a stable fashion, then this would be the zero B string. For the first analysis, which is semi-classical, let's just assume that we feel one side of the potential or the two sides, it won't make a difference. So for simplicity, I'll feel only one side of the potential. So now I'm going to do semi-classical quantization of this system. So here is a potential, and here is a classical particle moving back and forth in the potential. So how do we quantize this, such a particle semi-classically? Well, we learned that already from Bohr quantization, that the integral of the momentum times the coordinate lambda over the period is 2 pi n. So we define the two turning points. This would be lambda plus, this would be lambda minus. They are functions of the momentum or of the energy. So we have an integral. So let's evaluate this thing from lambda minus of the energy up to lambda plus of the energy times the momentum is square root of 2 energy minus u of the energy, u of lambda d lambda. And this whole thing equals pi over n. And I divided by a factor of 2 because I integrated only one half the cycle period rather than back and forth. So we think of n as being large, and if n is being large, then the energy levels are very, very dense here. So we can think of a density of states, rho of E, which is the density of states. Precisely, it's given by delta E minus En. But we're going to assume over all the energy levels that this becomes a smooth function, because this is going, there's going to be a continuum here, because there are lots and lots of states, and the potential is very, very far. Then the total number of fermions in the system is an integral from some cutoff, which I'll take mu zero to be mu zero, up to the final energy, highest energy mu, of rho of E dE. This is how we normalize the density of states. And the total energy, so I'm kind of abusing notation a little bit, the total energy is given as an integral over all possible, over all levels, we fill all the levels up to mu, of the energy times the density of states. So I'm going to use E both for the total energy and for the energy of the one body problem. And we integrate that again from some lower value, which we don't care about, up to mu. So what I've, this set of formulas from here down to here are completely standard. Now we are going to take this expression for the quantization and derive a formula for the asymptotic behavior. So rho of mu can be written as the change in the total number of fermions when we vary mu. Right, that's the change in the, what's the density? The density of eigenvalues is the number of eigenvalues divided by the derivative of the number of states divided by, with respect to the energy. But that we can do, evaluate from here. We'll just look at the last eigenvalue, substitute E equals mu here, and take the derivative. And this is becoming 1 over pi integral from lambda minus to lambda plus, now evaluated at mu, d lambda. divided by the square root 2 mu minus u of lambda. And if mu is near zero, which what we mean by is that the energies are very, very close to the tip of the potential, it's easy to see that this becomes 1 over pi log mu plus high order corrections. Taking this asymptotic behavior, substituting it here for the energy, we find that the energy, the total energy, is 1 over pi integral up to mu log e dE, which is 1 over 2 pi mu square log mu. I can tell you right away that this mu will end up what we called mu yesterday, although from here it's not obvious at all. So this is the semi-classical treatment. The total energy in the system depends on the Fermi energy. According to this formula, there's a mu squared log mu, and the derivation is rather elementary. Where did this thing come from? We tuned mu to be near the tip of the potential. So the only thing that matters is what the physics is near the tip of the potential. So therefore, we could have approximated, and in doing this integral, this is what we do, we can approximate u of lambda is minus a half lambda squared. So what I'll do for the rest of the talk is give an exact treatment of this system. So the treatment, the problem we are going to solve is the following. We forget the fact that we need to do many-body problem. We'll just look at the one-body problem of one body moving in an inverted harmonic oscillator potential. So this is the next topic, which is kind of an aside from the point of view of the general presentation here. But since this will be a rather elegant treatment of the system, which will give some insights, which will hopefully be relevant also in other systems, I thought I should spend some time doing it. So the problem we want to solve is to diagonalize a Hamiltonian, which is of the following form, or Lagrangian. So the Hamiltonian is minus a half d lambda square minus a half lambda square. So that's the title, the inverted harmonic oscillator problem. So the potential looks like this, and we have wave functions which oscillate here and here. How do we diagonalize this Hamiltonian? The traditional treatment is to say, well, we have to solve a differential equation like this, and you open your favorite special function book, and you learn that these eigenfunctions are known as parabolic cylinder functions. For me, such a statement is not very insightful. I don't know what a parabolic cylinder function is. So in the book, you find all sorts of formulas and identities it satisfies. But we would like to get some other treatment of the system. If the sign here were plus, then it is the standard harmonic oscillator. So then the treatment which is not insightful, analogous to saying that this is the parabolic cylinder function, is to say that the eigenfunction of the Hamiltonian with plus is a Hermite polynomial times some e to the minus lambda square. I guess we were used to that. To Hermite polynomials more, and they're polynomials, and therefore we like them more. But we all know that this is not the most efficient way to deal with the harmonic oscillator. There's a slightly more abstract way of dealing with the harmonic oscillator, not in terms of Hermite polynomials, but in terms of creation and annihilation operators. Or in a fancier language, we call them coherent states. So we write the system in terms of A and A dagger, which are the momentum plus or minus I times the coordinate. And then we can just work with that, but the really beautiful treatment is in terms of coherent states, coherent states are eigenfunctions of A and A dagger, and they are extremely powerful and useful. So we'll try to do the same thing here. We'll try to treat this system in a way which is similar to coherent states. There will be one important difference. A dagger is the Hermitian conjugate of A, or classically, A is the complex conjugate of A dagger. Therefore, they are not Hermitian operators. A and A dagger are not Hermitian operators. So when we diagonalize them by studying eigenstates of A and A dagger, of A or A dagger, we have to worry about funny inner products between them. And when we say that we have a state with eigenvalue, with a certain eigenvalue for A, the eigenvalue is not real because A is not Hermitian. And there's a whole discussion about the coherent states being overcomplete and so forth. Here, on the other hand, things are somewhat simpler. The analog of A and A dagger are S, which is 1 over root 2, lambda plus P, and U, which is 1 over root 2, lambda minus P. Right? These are the analog of A and A dagger. And they have the nice feature that they are real. Classically, they are real, and quantum mechanically, they are Hermitian. Since they are Hermitian, they can be diagonalized without any subtlety. So all the complications of coherent states, non-trivial inner products and this and that, are gone. And now we're going to do standard quantum mechanics when we diagonalize either S or U. So remember that quantum mechanically, the momentum P is minus I d by d lambda. And using that, we can compute the commutation relations of U and S. And the commutator is I, which means that U can be represented as I d by ds. So let's ignore for the moment the particular Hamiltonian we have and learn how we change basis between different between eigenfunctions of different differential operators. So it doesn't matter what the Hamiltonian is. We have states that we always like called lambda. These are eigenfunctions of lambda. And now we want to have states S and states U, which are eigenfunctions of S and U with the appropriate eigenvalue. I just write the eigenvalue here. So U and S are Hermitian operators. They can be diagonalized. We can have states which have eigenvalue S or eigenvalue U. They are not the same state. And it's straightforward to compute these inner products. So up to a phase, which is ambiguous, there's a root 2 pi. All these things are not too exciting. E to the I minus lambda square over 2 plus root 2 lambda S minus S square over 2. And this guy is 2 to the 1 quarter square root of 2 pi, e to the I, lambda square over 2, minus root 2 lambda u, plus u square over 2. And since u can be written as lambda plus I d by d lambda, and s can be written also in terms of lambda d by d lambda, you can just act with the differential operators and make sure that these two wave functions are indeed eigenfunctions of the differential operator S or the differential operator U. The precise form is determined such that this is the complex conjugate of the inverse. So if you act with differential operators on S, the wave function, which is an eigenfunction of lambda, you also get the right answer. So this is really a cute exercise for first course in quantum mechanics. There's really nothing deep in finding these functions. We can also check the inner product between S and U, which is square root I in my phase convention, which is not too exciting, 2 pi, e to the minus I, SU. In other words, S and U are conjugate variables. So the inner product between an eigenstate of U and an eigenstate of S is like a Fourier transform. So when we have a wave function in the S representation, we want to convert it to a wave function in the U representation. What we do is do a Fourier transform. So you can take your favorite wave function in the coordinate representation. If you know all these inner products, you can express the same state in the S representation or in the U representation. Is this clear? This is really first course quantum mechanics. So now that we have learned how to change bases, I'd like to go to our particular system and see how we diagonalize our Hamiltonian using this basis. So first, I'd like to have a picture of phase space. So the standard phase space has coordinate lambda and conjugate momentum p. Our S and U variables are this coordinate system. S is here, and U is here. So what kind of classical trajectories? Let's first look at the classical motion in that space. A particle can come here from here and be reflected here. Or a particle can come from here and be reflected here. This picture is very similar to the picture of Frindler's space that Shankar presented here. Although here it is motion in phase space. We also have the option of a particle coming here and reflected here. Or a particle coming from here and going here. So this and that, these two motions, this or that, correspond to particles moving above the barrier, like from the left or from the right. And the other motions, this and that, correspond to particles which are reflected off the barrier. So this is the classical picture. Let's see how we analyze it quantum mechanically. So our Lagrangian is really simple. It's 1/2 lambda dot square plus lambda square. Correspondingly, the Hamiltonian, which was 1/2 p square minus lambda square, is minus 1/2 su plus us. And if we're planning to work, say, in the S representation, we can write that as minus I s d by ds minus I over 2. So this is very similar to the a dagger a minus 1/2 that you are familiar with from the ordinary harmonic oscillator. And why are creation and annihilation operators nice? They are nice because the Hamiltonian is not quadratic in A. It's linear in A and linear in A dagger. That's why it works so easily. And similarly here, the Hamiltonian is no longer a second order differential operator, but it is a first order differential operator in S. So what are the energy eigenstates? We notice that S to the IE minus 1/2 is an eigenfunction with energy E. So the functional form of the eigenfunction is extremely simple. By analogy, this energy minus 1/2 is really the n of the standard harmonic oscillator, and this wave function is really a dagger to the n. But here we have a few i's here and there because of the, we're doing the inverted harmonic oscillator. So instead of having parabolic cylinder function, which are the eigenfunctions of this differential operator in the coordinate representation, we have very elementary functions. You can easily check that you substitute here, and you see that this is, maybe I copied things wrong, but it's in principle it's right. Actually, for every energy E, we can have two different eigenfunctions. Notice that the Hamiltonian is singular at S equals 0. So all the interesting physics will come from the fact that at S equals 0, we have a singularity. So we can have two separate wave functions or two separate states, which for no good reason at the moment, I'll call them state with energy E, labeled out, which is not well motivated now, E. And another guy will be energy also with the label out with the sign minus. And we are going to write their wave functions in the S representation. So this one is 1 over square root of 2 pi. That's for normalization. S to the IE minus a half. We'll take that for S positive and 0 for S negative. And this one will be the opposite, will be 0 for S positive and will be 1 over root 2 pi. S absolute value to the IE minus a half for S negative. And you can check that these two are two wave functions, two eigenfunctions of this Hamiltonian. So far, we worked in the S representation. We could also work in the U representation. And just as we have simple eigenfunctions in S, we also have simple eigenfunctions in U. So there are two states which have simple wave functions in the U representation. And for reasons that are not well motivated now, I'm just repeating the same words, they have this following wave function. So E, this is a state in, which will be motivated later. And we have another state, the energy E, still A with minus, whose wave functions are 1 over root 2 pi u to the minus IE minus a half for u positive and 0 for u negative and 0 for u positive and 1 over root 2 pi. The details are not important, but I'll put them anyway. U absolute value to the minus IE minus a half for u negative. So what did we find? In the S representation, we found two linearly independent eigenfunctions of the Hamiltonian. In the U representation, we found two linearly independent eigenfunctions of the Hamiltonian. But that means that there must be a linear transformation that takes these states to these states. For every energy E, there are only two linearly independent states in the Hilbert space. And we have given their wave functions in the S and in the U representation. So now we should be able to find a transformation that takes us from these states to these states. And this transformation is a 2x2 matrix. And the values of this matrix are, the entries of this matrix are independent of whether we are in the S representation or in the U representation. These are properties of the abstract vectors in the Hilbert space. So for simple, let me first write a general formula, and then I'll compute them. Yes? Because there's a singularity at S equals 0. So you see what the solutions are. We take this, 0 is also a solution. So I take something which is, has this functional form for S positive and 0 here. And the other has some functional form here and 0 here. So far, I'm exhibiting that as math. In 5 or 10 minutes, I'll give the physics of this, and it will be completely clear why there are two states and what they mean physically. And this whole formalism will have a simple physical interpretation. But I wanted to first have the formulas on the blackboard, and then I'll give the physical interpretation by pointing at them. That's quicker than the other way around. So at the moment, we are mathematicians. We are diagonalizing this differential operator. Singularity at S equals 0, so there are two independent wave functions. There will be physics in the singularity at X equals 0, or U equals 0. And if I don't explain it to your satisfaction, you'll be more than welcome to ask me again. So we know how to convert from the S basis to the U basis. we had this dictionary. This is F, X as a map from the S basis to the U basis over 2 pi, e to the minus ISU. So we can express these states, which we know their wave functions in the S basis. We can express them in the U basis, and then write them as linear combination of these two states, and it must be possible because there are only two linearly independent states. In other words, what we are after is something which is like an S matrix, E in plus, E in minus. That's a two-dimensional vector of vectors in the Hilbert space. Is a 2x2 matrix S, E out plus E out minus. Why I call this an S matrix is not yet clear, but this will end up being the S matrix of the system. So let me compute one of the entries of the matrix S to show you how elementary it is, and then I'll give the general formula. So for example, imagine we want to compute E out plus in a product with E prime in plus. So there's an I over root 2 pi, which is not too interesting, integral ds from 0 to infinity, integral du from 0 to infinity. So we put a complete set of states here. The in states are better expressed in the U representation, so we put in U, U, then we put S, S. So that's what we stick in here, and we integrate only from 0 to infinity rather than from minus infinity to infinity, because the plus wave functions have support only for positive S and for positive U. So this factor, the SU, gives us e to the minus I SU over 2 pi. And now we just copy the two wave functions, S to the minus I E minus a half, U to the minus I E prime minus a half. And now we want to do this two-dimensional integral. There's a convenient and quite intuitive change of variables. We can write U as R E to the minus phi, and S as R E to the plus phi. And when we change variables, the phi integral will implement energy conservation. So we're going to get a factor of delta of E minus E prime. This arises from the integral d phi. You see, phi doesn't appear here. It appears only here and here. And the minus a half cancels, and we get e to the I phi E minus E prime, and that gives us a delta function. Times an integral dr from 0 to infinity, dr. E to the minus r square. There is an I, and let me regularize that by putting 0 plus here to make sure that it converges. R to the minus 2i. This is just a little bit of algebra. And this integral is a gamma function. So we end up with our final formula for this entry. Oh, and I forgot, there's a factor of I over various factors which are not interesting. I over root 2 pi. So in the end of the day, we get here the delta function, root 2 pi, gamma of a half minus IE, e to the minus pi e over 2. So that's an example to compute one of the entries of S. And let me now give the general formula of S. And then I'll interpret the whole thing physically. So if we do the algebra, we have to repeat this exercise 4 times. It's not too much work. It's gamma of a half minus IE divided by square root of 2 pi e to the minus pi e over 2, I e to the I to the pi e over 2, I e to the pi e over 2, and e to the minus pi e over 2. And this can also be written as e to the I big phi of e, 1 over square root, let's see if I can fit it here, 1 plus e to the 2, 1 over square root of 1 plus e to the 2 pi e, I over square root of 1 plus e to the minus 2 pi e, I over square root of 1 plus e to the minus 2 pi e, and 1 over square root of 1 plus e to the 2 pi e. Okay, so after this long and boring calculation and math without physics, I'd like to say what's going on here. First thing, notice that this matrix S is unitary. This is kind of a check on our whole formalism. We have a two-dimensional Hilbert space for given energy E, and we have two natural bases, the in basis and the out basis. So the translation between them has to be a unitary transformation. And all the states are properly normalized. That's what all the I's and the two pi's do. Let's look at incoming classical particles. Incoming classical particles come either from here or from here, either from lambda very big and positive or lambda very big and negative. And they rush inwards. So all the incoming states come from here or from here. So incoming states have large values of U and small values of S. So incoming states have U absolute value much bigger than 1, and S is approximately 0. Outgoing states have S absolute value much bigger than 1, and U approximately 0. So the outgoing states are here and here. Therefore, it's clear that incoming states should have nice wave functions in the U representation, while outgoing states should have nice wave functions in the S representation. Indeed, the state that comes from here in the U representation should have support only for positive U. It has no support with negative U. So the support of the incoming states in the U representation is telling us, whether it's supported in this region of U or in this region of U, tells us whether the particle comes from the right or comes from the left. So wave functions which have simple description in the U representations are incoming states, and wave functions which have simple description in the S representation are outgoing states. And the label plus and minus simply tells us whether the particles come from the right or from the left, whether the particle comes from here or come from here. The same is true in the S representation for the out states. But notice what happens to the U wave function. So we start from a wave function which is supported here in the U representation. So only at U positive. It has some overlap with, in the S representation, it is has support both for positive S and for negative S. Describing the amplitude to move this way or that way. Or in coordinate space, if we send a particle from here, it has a certain amplitude to be reflected back and a certain amplitude to go out. This is what this S matrix is telling us. That the state, say this way it's the in state with plus, can be written as linear combinations of out states with both plus and minus. So imagine we start with this state. It's an in state with plus, so the particle coming from here. And that wave function can be written as linear combination of a state with support here and a state with support here. This is what the S matrix is telling us. So that's why we should call it an S matrix. Let's have some checks on this interpretation. Imagine that E is very big and positive. So imagine E goes to plus infinity. If E goes to plus infinity, this is big, and this is big, and this is small, and this is small. We can approximate the diagonal terms as zero. And we learn that state E in is approximately given by state E out, where this has a plus, this has a minus, and this is a plus, and this has a minus. In other words, for very high energy, we are way above the barrier. If we want to start here, we are most likely to end on this side of the barrier. Whereas if we start here, we are most likely to end up here. This is to be contrasted with the situation when the energy goes to minus infinity. Now the off-diagonal terms are small, and the diagonal terms are big. So energy eigenstates in with plus or minus are approximately equal to energy outstate, again with plus or minus. In other words, starting on the right with very, very negative energy, we are most likely to be reflected back than to penetrate through the barrier. So these are two limits which exhibit, which give us consistency checks, some intuition about these states. Are there any questions about this formalism? Yes. Absolutely. I don't know what's natural and unnatural. This is just another representation of the same states. If you write these wave functions, let's distinguish between states and wave functions. They're not the same thing. The Hilbert space has, for every energy E, there are two linearly independent states. One particle coming from here, and the other particle coming from here. If you do your favorite exercise of a barrier in quantum mechanics, there's a two-dimensional vector space of states for every energy E, describing particles coming from here or particles coming from here. The novelty here is not in finding the states. The novelty is in finding the presentation, you know, or the representation. In quantum mechanics, you can have representation. Kind of, how do you represent these particular states in terms of eigenstates of a particular operator? So you pick your favorite operator, and you look at what the wave function looks like in that, in terms of eigenstates of this operator. So here, we decided to pick these S and U operators, where the wave functions are elementary, as opposed to the operator lambda, where the wave function is very complicated. You can take any one of these expressions, and I gave you the dictionary from the S representation to the lambda representation, and write an integral transform of these wave functions to the other presentation. And what you're going to find is an integral representation of the parabolic cylinder function. But I find these wave functions a lot easier to work with, and especially because they have this simple interpretation. Now, I'd like to stress that the analogy with Rindler, which is indeed correct, might be a little bit misleading, because this picture, which appears also in your books about Rindler space, describes different things. In Rindler space, these are space and time. Here, these are coordinate and momentum. This is motion in phase space, not to be confused by motion in space and time. Time runs here along the trajectory. I'd be happy to discuss it in more detail. I'd really like to take the lowbrow approach here, where we're simply taking these are the wave functions of these states. We just take convenient presentation of them. Any more questions? So equipped with that, I'm ready to move to the second quantized problem. Recall, the problem we're really interested in is not just a single harmonic oscillator, but we want a bunch of fermions, lots of fermions, which move in that space. And our reflexes, so all of them are moving around, so all the fermions are doing such trajectories, and we would like to do a second quantized problem. So we take exactly the same system, and we'll take your favorite book of second quantization, and we just repeat what the textbook tells us to do. So how do we do second quantization? We take, first of all, we define a fermion operator, fermion creation operator. It creates a fermion at the point. And we write a second quantized Hamiltonian for this system, or Lagrangian for that fermion field. So the standard description is the following. We write an integral d lambda, integral over space. This would be the Lagrangian. We have a fermion field, which is a function of lambda and t. And then we have I d by dt. And then we have to write minus the Hamiltonian, which in our case is 1/2 d lambda square plus 1/2 lambda square. And now we subtract this chemical potential which we introduced earlier, psi of lambda and t. So that's the problem we want to solve. So if you really want to solve this problem without changing to the S and U variables, you're welcome to do that. This was done some 20 years ago, so maybe only 15. But now that we have our simpler wave function, let's see what happens to this problem in this simpler presentation. So everything we did can just be copied. We are going to define another creation operator, or annihilation operator, psi s, which is now a function of s and t, which is given by an integral transform, so there are two i's, that's not too exciting, to the 1/4, 2 pi. These are various normalizations so that we preserve norm. And now we take our transform from lambda to s, e to the I, lambda square over 2 minus root 2 s lambda plus s square over 2 psi of lambda and t. So if you don't like the field operator, psi of lambda of t, you can work with this one. And similarly, there is a U representation operator, which has the same factor on my complex conjugate, minus 2i to the 1/4, square root of 2 pi, integral d lambda, e to the minus I, and these two operators are related to one another by a Fourier transform. So psi s of s and t is an integral du over root 2 pi e to the minus I s u psi u of u and t. If we think of it as a field theory, this is a very strange thing to do. We take a local field, psi of lambda of t is a local field, and we write it in terms of another local field, psi of s and u, except that the transformation between this local field and this local field is non-local. So the local field psi of s and t is not local in terms of the local field psi of lambda and t. This is a very unusual thing to do. In other words, the value of the field psi s of s and t at the point s and t depends not only on the value of the field psi of lambda, the original field, at a given point lambda, or maybe it's a slight neighborhood of it, but it depends on what the other field does everywhere in space. It's a non-local transform. So we have here three non-local transforms, going from lambda to s, from lambda to u, and another one from s to u. We very rarely do such a thing in quantum field theory. And there's good reason why we very rarely do that, because it's non-local. And there's something very interesting in the fact that we can do it here, and we get some mileage out of it. Yes, there was a question. That's not a big problem, because this thing really commutes with the energy eigenstates. So non-local as it is, it does not map different eigenstates. So if you write the operator as creation operators and annihilation operators with wave functions, you should really be thinking of them as the coefficient, not as wave functions, but states in the Hilbert space, in the one-body Hilbert space. And then what we use here are the different representations of this one-body, I shouldn't call them wave function, one-body eigenstates. And we describe wave functions in different representations. In terms of fields, it's non-local. So whether that's perfectly possible. I'm not familiar with the Gabor function, so maybe you can explain it to me afterwards. Here it came from just we diagonalized another differential operator, so that's what comes. Maybe this whole thing is even more standard than I thought. So what are we going to do? We should take this transform and express our Lagrangian in terms of the new variables. To do that, it's really more convenient to do the inverse of that. But that's not a big deal. I'm just going to give you the answer. So we can take this non-local transform and express our problem in these new variables and see, well, why do we do all that? We do all that only if it ends up being useful. If it did not end up being useful, I would not have been bothering you with all that. So this Lagrangian can be written as an integral ds from minus infinity to infinity, psi dagger is S field I d by dt plus I over 2 S d by ds ds plus ds S minus mu psi S. In fact, we don't really need to compute anything in order to see that, because after all, this is the one-body Hamiltonian. But as a check, you can see that it works. If we didn't start with this, we could have started with that. So we have, how do we second quantize the problem? Well, we write id by, we write psi dagger and psi, and then we write the id by dt, and then we write the Hamiltonian, and then we put our chemical potential. And it's straightforward to write it also in the U representation. That's interesting. We took a second order Lagrangian which was first order in time, but second order in space, and we wrote it in terms of a Lagrangian, which is now first order in space. Of course, the price we pay is that the transformation is non-local. But nevertheless, we succeeded to take this second order in lambda, first order in t, and write it as first order in t and first order in s. But to make life even simpler than that, I'm now going to make a local change of variables. As opposed to all these deep non-local changes of variables, local changes of variables are simple. So I'm going to define psi int plus minus of r and t is e to the r over 2. That's an uninteresting overall factor. Psi s at s equals plus or minus e to the r t. And psi out plus or minus of r and t is e to the r over 2 psi u equals plus or minus e to the r t. And this is just a local change of variable. It's really easy to put it in. You see this, one of them has support only, the plus or minus here, which is correlated with the plus or minus here, tells us whether this thing has support at S positive or at S negative. And now we get to our final form of the Lagrangian, which is an integral dr, sum over I equals 1 to 2. These are these plus or minus. Psi dagger in I dt minus I dr minus mu psi in I. And this thing is the same, very similar, dr, sum I equals plus or minus psi dagger out I dt. Now we have plus I dr minus mu psi out I. So in the end of the day, we don't just have three fermions in the sense that we had before, fermions that don't talk to one another, but now we have three fermions which are free in the sense that they are relativistic. We took this system with the potential, which was non-relativistic quantum mechanics. This is non-relativistic second quantized quantum mechanics. And we wrote it exactly in terms of free relativistic fermions. So it's not just that the fermions are free, that they don't interact with one another. That already happened here. But these fermions are also free in the sense that they're free relativistic fermions. We have seen a glimpse of it already here when the Lagrangian became first order. But now we see that the first order also here. I'd really like to stress that there's no approximation here. I did not approximate things, things that are near the turning point, near far from the potential and all that. This is exact rewriting of the problem. The second thing I'd like to stress is that normally when we write a quantum field and we write it as linear combination of incoming and outgoing state operators, so we write phi as a linear combination of a dagger incoming plus a dagger or a outgoing and so forth. So every operator has creation operators in the incoming and annihilation operators on the outgoing and so forth. We don't have that here. It's not that the original field, psi, is a linear combination of incoming and outgoing fields. That's not the case. The original field can be written either as an incoming field or as an outgoing field. The incoming description is a complete description of the physics. The outgoing description is a complete description of the physics. And the S matrix is the dictionary between the incoming and the outgoing descriptions. The next point I'd like to stress is the non-local nature of all these transformations. Tying it a little bit with the discussion yesterday, there are many things here which we can call space. Yesterday, space was called phi. Today, the beginning, space was this lambda, space of where the eigenvalues move. Now we call space this coordinate r. In fact, we have two different coordinates r, for the right incoming and for the outgoing. And these different coordinates, these different things which we call space, are non-locally related to one another. Things which are local in lambda are non-local in S, and things which are local in S are non-local in U. So we have lots and lots of different descriptions here. S and U, every one of them has its own R and lambda. And yesterday we had phi. All of these will end up in the physics be the holographic coordinate of space. So Steve Shanker really underscored and really stressed the importance of understanding local physics. So we sit at infinity. How do we reconstruct local physics? And I'm going to ask Steve now, local physics in which variable? Is local physics in phi, or local physics in S, or local physics in U, or should we keep changing variables at our will? Or maybe one of them is preferred over the others. Phi was really natural yesterday. Lambda was really natural at the beginning of the discussion today. And I think nobody is going to deny that these are the simplest variables. Our complete interacting string theory is given by free relativistic fermions. But they are free in a space which is non-locally related to where we started. So these were some general philosophical comments. Now let's get to work and see whether this formalism can teach us something. Why do we have two species here? Well, before that, I want to say one more thing. We have this translation between psi u and psi s. We can write it in this language also in terms of translation between psi in and psi out. After all, this change of variables is rather trivial. Notice what happens here. We take the psi in and psi out in this R representation. They describe these are different fields, non-locally related to one another. But one of them has a minus sign here, the other has a plus sign here. In other words, as relativistic fermions, they move in opposite directions. So we take a free relativistic fermion, which moves one way, and we write it exactly as a free relativistic fermion, which moves in the opposite way. Where is all the non-trivial physics? So we have free relativistic fermions. Where is the non-trivial physics? The non-trivial physics is in this formula. Or equivalently, we can write it in R, because this is a trivial change of variables. So the non-trivial physics, the non-trivial S matrix, the fact that this theory is an interacting string theory, interacting enriched string theory, all this information is lumped into this Fourier transform. Because this is a free relativistic field, this is a free relativistic field, but they are related to one another in this complicated way by a Fourier transform. What are the symmetries of the problem? Symmetries is always something I like because no matter how complicated the problem is, symmetries is something we can always hold on to because it will guide us. So we look at this Lagrangian, and we see with the naked eye an SU2 symmetry. We have two species of fermions. We have two complex fermions. Both of them are, say, left-moving, and we have an SU2 that rotates between them. I'll refer to this SU2 as SU2 in. And we look at this Lagrangian, we also see an SU2 symmetry, which I can refer to as SU2 out. Where did these two SU2s come from? The reason we have two species of fermions is that in the S representation, there was something special at S equals 0. S equals 0 is really asymptotic of space-time. So we come from here, which is this is S equals 0. This is where we come from. And no wonder S equals 0 is a singular point. In other words, we have two asymptotic regions, here and here. And that's the origin, if you look through the formalism, this is the reason we have two species of fermion. We have two species of fermion because some of them come from here, one of them comes from here, and the other comes from here. And we also have two species of outgoing fermion. One of them goes there, and the other goes here. So this SU2 is a very strange symmetry from this perspective. It's a symmetry that rotates a fermion that comes from the left into a fermion that comes from the right. Yet, it is an exact symmetry in this description. But it's not an exact symmetry of our problem. One way to see that is to notice that it's not a symmetry of this transform. So we broke the system into three pieces. We have the incoming Lagrangian, which is rather trivial, and it has an SU2 symmetry. We have an outgoing Lagrangian, which is rather trivial, and it has an outgoing symmetry. And all the mess, all the complications are in this Fourier transform, which is non-local. And it breaks the two SU2 symmetries. So this is very similar to what we discussed yesterday. In the asymptotic region, we have two SU2 symmetries, SU2 of the incoming guys and SU2 of the outgoing guys. The exact system doesn't have the SU2 symmetry. Too bad, but the SU2 symmetry can still be used to classify the incoming and outgoing states. How can we do that? Well, we have here three relativistic fermions. It really begs to bosonize them and form currents. So J in is up to some factors dt plus dr of some field I'll call phi in, which is the bosonized fermion here. And similarly, J out is dt minus dr times some phi out, where this current is roughly psi dagger psi. This is roughly psi dagger psi, and it's really plus minus the minus. Sorry, maybe it is that. These currents should be identified with the derivative of the C field that we had yesterday. The derivative of the C field, where the third component of this SU2 and the exponential of the C field was the SU2 itself, the off-diagonal elements. So yesterday, so this is roughly, and this is very, very roughly, d plus c, and this is roughly, again, very, very roughly, d minus c that we had yesterday. These are the two-third component of isospin. We also have other states in the theory that yesterday we could not identify. We said that the C field was at the self-dual radius, therefore there must be an SU2 symmetry. And many people ask me later, how can that be? We don't see an SU2 in the Lagrangian. And I always told them, look, you have a conformal field theory, the self-dual radius, it must have an SU2 symmetry. The world sheet did not give us the other states. The states which enhance the quanta of C into an SU2 symmetry, into an SU2 multiplet. In terms of these fermions, it's completely clear what it is. The quanta of C will end up being deformations of this Fermi C coming from here and here. So we create a fermion, annihilate a fermion, and so forth. The non-trivial element will be excitations of the Hilbert space when we create a fermion here and we annihilate it here. These are non-perturbative excitations that string theory has, and the world sheet was incapable of seeing, and surprisingly, these excitations are massless. So this string theory has massless excitations, massless solitons, which are non-perturbative, that's why they're solitons, and the world sheet cannot see them. Before we break to lunch, I'll say what I've just said, I'll say in much more detail tomorrow. But before we break to lunch, I'd like to, so we talked a little bit about the SU2s in the problem. I'd like to talk a little bit about the Z2 in the problem. So the SU2 are symmetries which are there only in the asymptotic region. They are not precise symmetries of the problem. This is to be contrasted with the Z2 problems of the system. Recall we had two Z2 symmetries. One of them was minus one to the space-time fermion number left, and the other was minus one to the world sheet fermion number left. So these were these two symmetries. The first was charge conjugation. The second was this S-duality, which was more interesting. We can see them in this formalism, and they have to be an exact symmetry of the problem, i.e., symmetries of these Lagrangians and symmetries of the non-trivial transform between the different fields. This is what it means to be a precise symmetry of the problem. Precise symmetry of the problem is a symmetry of these Lagrangians and a symmetry of the transform. So let me just give you the symmetries, and then we can all go to have lunch. So the first symmetry, which was just charge conjugation, that was the trivial symmetry, minus one to the F left, charge conjugation. Can be identified here with the symmetry that takes lambda or u or s to minus lambda minus u or minus s. In other words, it takes one side of the potential and maps it here. Notice that in this description, we have two asymptotic regions. In yesterday's description, there was only one asymptotic region. So this asymptotic region and this one together form the boundary of space. And this symmetry is a symmetry that flips the potential like that. And it's a, if you can follow it through, you can see that it's an exact symmetry of the problem. The other symmetry is a little bit more interesting. The worksheet has left, which we called S-duality. That symmetry does the following thing. It takes psi, we call them plus in, and maps it to psi in dagger. Two, and psi out plus minus, sorry, this is minus, is taken to psi dagger out plus minus. So up to this exchange with plus and minus here, what it does, it makes psi, takes psi into its complex conjugate. Again, this is a precise symmetry of the problem, except that here it changes mu to minus mu. See it also here. Takes mu to minus mu. Everything else is invariant. This is charge conjugation of these fermions. So the charge conjugation of space-time becomes parity of the fermions. We flip the two sides of the potential. And this S-duality becomes charge conjugation of the fermions. So it is encouraging to see that our description at least has all the symmetries that we discussed yesterday. And I'll continue to elaborate on the dictionary between space-time and this matrix model tomorrow. Let's get some lunch.